welcome back to the Spartan History Podcast. This is episode 18, Jason and the Golden Fleece, part 4. That's right, folks. The final installment in my retelling of Apollonius's tale. It is admittedly with some degree of relief that I can close the chapter in this mini-series. Though with between 6,000 to 8,000 words still to write, any relief I feel at the moment would be slightly presumptuous. We'll get straight into part 4 this time, as I'll finish this episode with an extensive conclusion to the main character's storylines, and a few parting observations I've picked up over the series. Part 3 began with the Argonauts vacillating by the water's edge as to the next move, the full weight of being stranded in enemy territory weighing heavily upon them. Fortunately, Hera and Athena decided to rescue them from their collective ineptitude and set in motion a plan so dastardly, with such little regard for human life, that it could only come from one of the Olympians. Enlisting Aphrodite and her son Eros, they bewitched the mind of Medea into aiding their schemes. King Aetes seemingly set Jason the impossible task of yoking the fire-breathing bulls and ploughing the field of Ares. Into the furrows he was to plant dragon's teeth and defeat the earthborn creatures that arose from the foul seed. Sounds impossible to me, but I listened to part 3 and know that Medea, having previously reached an accord of love with Jason, gave him every device and means to defeat the task at hand. We finished with a delighted bunch of Argonauts returning to the Argo to indulge in celebration, and in opposition, a more than slightly piqued King Aetes returning to his palace, plotting their demise. Be damned if he'd give them the fleece, or let them live for their effrontery. Too right, barely does Apollonius have the time to invoke the blessings of the Muses before Aetes takes centre stage, pondering all the weird and wonderful ways to kill Jason and his merry band of Argonauts. Deep within his mind, however, there is a seed of doubt that was planted by the way in which his challenge was defeated. Which member of his family had betrayed him? The thought only fanned the flames of his rage. Indeed, those flames licked at the heels of a pacing Medea, hidden in her chambers, foreboding welling deep in her breast. Always looking to the future, ever watchful Hera took that feeling of doom and magnified it tenfold. The goddess's true goal was the demise of King Pelias back in Iolcus, and she wasn't taking any chances with Jason being the vehicle for her vengeance. She needed Medea out of the palace and on board the Argo. Apart from a faithful husband, Hera generally got what she wanted, and before long Medea was fleeing from her home to where she knew the Argo to be docked. In the darkness of night, she climbed the banks of the Phasis River, spying the Argonauts upon their ship in repose around a flaming cauldron, toasting to the success earlier achieved on the field of Ares. She called out to them thrice, but staring into the gloom from the fire's edge, they couldn't see her, though the voice they all recognised. After a time of rowing hither and thither, they eventually zeroed in on her location, and as the men were securing the ship onto the bank, Jason leapt to the ground before Medea. Riven with fear, she collapsed to the ground, clasping his knees and beseeching him to take her from this land that was once her home. If he would do that, she would in turn help him retrieve the fleece from its serpent guardian. With his men bearing witness, Jason set her at ease and swore that once they returned to Greece, he would make her his wife. With that, they reboarded the Argo, and at the princess's direction, rowed straight for the Grove of Ares. Reaching the designated location, the pair alighted upon a grassy patch known colloquially as the Ram's Couch. So called because after the long journey from Orchomenos, it was the first place the golden ram touched down and relinquished the burden of Phrixus from its back. Nearby was the soot-stained altar on which the creature was rewarded for its service by being sacrificed to Zeus. From there, slinking up the path towards their target, the lovers were wary of the serpentine sentinel they knew to be there. The beast's gigantic, golden eyes saw them first, and like two golden orbs, they shot forward as its coiled body unraveled towards them. With a whistling intake, a hiss shot forth from the gaping maw of the snake, so loud and dreadful that it echoed along the Phasis and across the Black Sea. Mothers, we are told, in distant lands, woke immediately to soothe their babies who writhed in despair at the fell sound. Jason was rooted to the spot in terror, but Medea strode proudly forward, screaming out a prayer to her mistress Hecate to induce the serpent to sleep. Falling under her spell, its scaly neck began to slacken, and as she sprinkled a charm in its eyes, the snake collapsed, asleep. The object of his fear acquiescent before him, Jason could finally move, and with Medea, the two walked into the moonlit grove of Ares and beheld its prize. Iason's son relieved the oak tree of its burden, and like a mantle, placed the fleece around his shoulders. There it shimmered, the light of Selene refracting in all directions in a shimmer of gold. Gathering its folds around him, ostensibly to keep it secure, but really because he didn't want to get it dirty, the pair headed back towards the Argo. Just quickly, there is evidence for a vastly different version of this part of the myth. On the website, you'll see a picture of what is known as the Duda's Cup. It has a very interesting image of Jason being regurgitated by the serpent. I believe this image reflects the very ancient roots of the story. The descent into the belly of the beast, usually a dragon, in search of that which is most valuable is a common archetypal story in most ancient cultures' repertoires. Generally, the hero, after attaining the treasure, disperses it amongst the people to everyone's benefit. And that obviously didn't fit with Apollonius' narrative, and fair enough. It's a worthy aside, regardless. At the sight of Jason bearing the fleece, the Argonauts let out a cheer of joy and an audible sigh of relief. The object of their quest secured, they could now return home. However, it wasn't only mothers and babies that were disturbed by the sound of the serpent's hiss. For King Aetes, mulling over recent events in the not-so-distant palace, it completed the puzzle of betrayal in his mind. Rosy-fingered Dawn was spreading her tendrils into the sky as he roused his men, donned his armour, and mounted the podium of his chariot. Absyrtus, his son, stood ready with reins in hand and whipped the brilliant steeds into motion. Coming to the river's edge, the king shrieked a curse, witnessing the fully armed Argonauts at their rowing benches. Now, to say the king was already angry would be a gross understatement, but when he saw the dark hair of his daughter at the ship's prow, he positively dissolved into paroxysms of rage. Screaming at his son, Absyrtus, to head to the docks and launch his navy in pursuit. Imagine, if you will, the king himself, down at the docks, pushing the vessels from their moorings, hoping to speed the chase, all the while spitting blue murder. Now that last part didn't happen in the Argonautica, but it does make for an amusing mental image. The world of Apollonius's time drew its northern border at Macedonia and Thracia. Beyond those places was the great unknown land of the Hyperboreans, or men living beyond the north wind. Bisecting this strange place was the Istros, or Danube River. Until the Roman conquest in the 1st and 2nd century CE of Pannonia, Moesia, and Dalmatia, this river's course and source were only very dimly understood by the Greco-Roman world. To Apollonius's mind, the Danube, although circuitous, would still be a viable option for sailing through to the Adriatic Sea, something a cursory glance at a modern map will disprove in a second. Now remember Phineas? He's the too honest seer that was punished with physical blindness for telling the truth. If that wasn't bad enough, Zeus sent harpies to torment him at mealtime, who came down and defecated on the poor old guy's food. Yuck. Luckily for Phineas, that was yesterday. Well, several days ago now, to be sure. Jason and his men had alleviated the burdens of Phineas's life and chased the harpies away. As a reward, he gave the Argonauts a prophecy about their assured success in their quest, but also warned them that in order to return home safely, they would have to travel back via a different path. As the Argo left the Phasis onto the Black Sea, Jason discerned the cryptic meaning of the blind man's words and set course for the Istros. Absyrtus, who was no idiot when it came to his geography, split his father's fleet, sending half through the Bosphorus and the other half in the direction of the river. The latter force he led personally. What ensued was surely the greatest naval chase in mythology as the Colchian fleet tried to chase down the Argo. From Colchis to the Brygian Islands, which is where they all eventually entered into the Adriatic by some distant offshoot of the Istrus, it's a journey as the crow flies of 2,200 kilometres, or nearly 1,400 miles. Inasmuch as Apollonius dedicates barely 2 pages to the journey, it's a largely uneventful trip. Somewhere along the way, Absyrtus and his fleet get ahead of Jason and are waiting for them in ambush around the islands. Any hopes Absyrtus had of remaining hidden were dashed by the Argo having Lynceus, the brother of Aetes, on board. If you remember the episode on the Dioscuri, he had particularly good eyesight and was basically like Superman. As they sailed from the river and into the Adriatic, Lynceus spotted the waiting fleet and raised an alarm. In council, the Argonauts decided that the fleece was their right. Regardless of stealing it, they had earlier in fact won it fairly. They would fight and die for it, if necessary. The problem as they saw it was the Medea question. To To this, they imagined leaving her on a nearby island that had a temple of Artemis on it. In the goddess's care she would remain until through parley the Argonauts could discern her brother's wishes. One thing you notice as the Argonautica progresses is a degeneration of character in the so-called heroes of the narrative. From high ideals, they descend into more base, more puerile attitudes towards the quest and the people they encounter. The same can most certainly be said for Medea, and although there are glimpses of it earlier, the true degradation of her persona begins here as she misconstrues the Argonauts' intentions as to her fate. Coming into the back end of a conversation, she unloads a 40-line invective on Jason, invoking all manner of damnation and punishment on the ungrateful son of a you-know-what. In what is one of the truly memorable dialogues of the entire epic, allow me to share some of its impetus from Apollonius's writings. "Be ready to save me. Let justice and right, to which we have both agreed, stand firm. Or else you should at once cut off your own head with your own sword, that I might have just reward for my mad passion. I hope you at some time remember me when you are racked with guilt and anguish. May the fleece vanish like a dream into the darkness on the wings of the wind." Apollonius finishes with, "Thus she spoke, seething with fierce wrath, and she longed to set fire to the ship and to hew it utterly in pieces and herself to fall into the raging flame." It's fairly heavy stuff, and her propensity for revenge is something deeply explored by the great Athenian tragedians. Writing sometime before the Argonautica, they dined out on her rage. She is probably the most complex character in the entire book, more entertaining by far than the star of the show, who at his best is generally insipid and at worst forgettable. But more on that later. At any rate, a sufficiently berated Jason ventures to tell Medea that their concern was merely over her safety, as if they chose to fight before talking with her brother, she could be in danger of the death they will surely face. But if by handing over the daughter of King Aetes first, they might ensure her safety and be free to give a good account of themselves in battle. Upon hearing how vehemently she desired to stay by his side, Jason offered her a third option, if she was willing. He proposed she personally lure her brother into talks, letting him know that she had made a mistake and wished to betray Jason and herself return home. At which moment, and with her consent, Jason would strike him down. This, Jason said, would send confusion amongst the rest of his men, and leaderless, they would lose their resolve. Medea readily agreed, and after a communication with an unsuspecting Apsyrtus, the ambush was set. The Colchian flagship dropped off its leader and stayed nearby. On the other side of the island, the Argo docked with Medea and Jason disembarking. The princess went straight to the prearranged meeting point at the Temple of Artemis, whilst Jason secreted himself within striking distance. As Apsyrtus came into the clearing and saw his sister for the first time since leaving home, he was completely beguiled by her cunning words. She told him that together they would take the fleece from Jason and sail back to Colchis, where everything would be forgiven. Apsyrtus readily nodded his assent to the plan, when Jason rose up from the undergrowth and struck him down like a butcher strikes down a mighty strong bull. Well, that's how Apollonius puts it, at any rate. Medea did have the decency to avert her gaze as her beloved slaughtered her brother and then desecrated the body. At her signal by torchlight, the waiting Argo sailed around the headlands and attacked the waiting Colchian ship and killed every last man on it. Sailing away into the night, the massacre was noticed the next day by the rest of King Aetes' fleet, and, as imagined, they lost the will to fight without their leader. Rather than report back to their vengeful overlord that they allowed his son to die, they settled in the area where in the 2nd century CE the islands were known as the Apsyrtians. The murder most foul was noticed also by Zeus, who, filled with wrath at the Argonauts in their lack of common decency, cursed them. Unless they sought out Circe on her island and received her ritual cleansing, the Argo would be sent on its own little odyssey and face great struggle and protracted strife on its journey home. Unaware of the gods' plans for them, the Argonauts sailed on down the Adriatic and towards doom. As always, Hera was watching out for them. Creating a massive storm, she sent the Argo back the other direction, whilst her voice whispered on the wind that they must seek out Circe to propitiate Zeus. Now Circe, I think it's Kirke in ancient Greek, but it's very difficult to pronounce, played a fairly major role in Odysseus's Odyssey, where she turns his men into pigs and through her guile very nearly traps the complicated man for all time. the daughter of the sun god Helios and a water nymph named Perse. She was the brother of King Aetes and therefore the aunt of Medea. Living on the island of Iai, she was a renowned and notorious practitioner of the dark arts in Greek mythology. One of Homer's epithets for her is Polypharmakos, which means knowing many drugs and charms. Although not mentioned in the Odyssey, Hesiod, in his Theogony, mentions that Odysseus fathered three sons with Circe, who were born and raised on her island. The last book in the Trojan epic cycle, which is now lost, the Telegony, purportedly told the story of this third son, the eponymous Telegonus. During his quest to find his father, he unwittingly kills him and brings him back to the island of Iai for burial. It was to this place that the Argo headed at the bequest of Hera, sailing up the Po River, and through some non-existent byways entered into the Ligurian Sea on the west coast of Italy, where Iai was located. Leaving the Argo and its crew behind, Jason and Medea go forth to the lair of Circe and make themselves suppliants before her. The sorceress isn't entirely sure at first why they are there. She assumes that the mere fact that they have sought her out must mean dire events transpiring, and she begins a series of sacrifices to appease the gods. Rites finalized, she turns to the pair and inquires as to their coming. Listening to the tale in shocked silence, Medea no sooner finishes her recount than Circe banishes them back to the waiting ship, telling them that there is no place at her hearth for the slayers of her kin. Absyrtus was, after all, her nephew. Meanwhile, Hera is still in the background working on the return of the Argo and its heroes back to Greece. On the west side of Italy, the journey home was fraught with a great many dangers, so she enlisted the help of the water nymph Thetis, mother of Achilles. Thetis and her cantankerous nature were well known to the goddess, but her weakness was her young son, Achilles, who even now was being raised by the wise centaur Chiron on the slopes of Mount Pelion. This mountain is looking more and more like some strange type of daycare center for baby Greek heroes, with a centaur as an instructor. Hera foretells the nymph that when Achilles is in the underworld, he will be the husband to none other than Medea. Therefore, it behooves her to now act in kindness to a future daughter-in-law, as only a mother-in-law should, and aid the Argonauts in their quest. Convinced, the mother of Achilles sunk to the depths to hold counsel with her sister nymphs, the Nereids. All in accord, the 50 sisters return to the Argo, just as she is setting sail from Iai. Thetis alone approaches her husband Peleus, who, looking over the gunwales, was surprised to see his long-lost wife rising from the depths. For a brief recap, Zeus was in love with Thetis and wanted her as his own, typically. Thetis rebuffed his advances until a prophecy foretold that the son of Thetis would grow to be greater than the father. Clearly Zeus was having none of that, jealous as he was of power. Moreover, he'd be damned if any other god fathered a child with her either. Just too risky. She was forced to marry a mortal instead, and Hera, due to Thetis's previous rebuffing of her philandering husband, made sure it was a mortal worthy of such a prize. It was the wedding of Thetis and Peleus that led to the judgment of Paris, and sealed the fate of Troy. The pair seemed happy for a time, and they welcomed into the world a baby boy whom they called Achilles, whose name meant the distress of the soldiers by one translation. His rage alone saw much grief for the fighting men in both camps at Troy. Having the gift of sight, Thetis was perpetually worried over her immortal son's eventual death. To avoid that fate, every night she burnt the baby's flesh, and in the morning anointed him with the nectar of the gods, ambrosia. The hope was that this would turn the baby boy into an immortal. It might have worked too, but Peleus woke up one night and witnessed her burning his son to death, or so he thought. Justifiably scared and furious, Peleus let out a death-curdling scream at his wife to stop at once. She, ropeable at his interference and failure to grasp her mysterious ways, tossed the screaming baby to the floor and left their bridal chamber, never to return. The story of her dipping young Achilles into the river Styx whilst holding him by the heel seems to be a much later Roman invention. Homer in the Iliad mentions that she was forced to leave Peleus due to his age, so perhaps the two made amends eventually and reconciled. Either way, this was the first time Peleus had seen his beautiful wife since that night of fire. There was to be no happy reunion for the couple here. In fact, Thetis reminds her husband of his prior transgression before telling him that at the request of Hera, her and her sister nymphs were there to help. instructing him to tell no one of her coming, and to rouse the Argonauts to sail immediately south. The Nereids, with Hera's backing, would take care of the rest. Sail they did, and soon they came to the islands of the Sirens, where the sweet song of these creatures lured passing sailors and their ships onto the rocky outcrops and into the depths. Odysseus later defeated them by giving each member of his crew a bit of wax with which to plug their ears while he himself was tied to the mast so that he might listen to the song. He didn't have Orpheus, though, whom the Argonauts employed to make his own song to drown out that of the temptresses. The plan worked almost flawlessly, save that one of their number couldn't resist and leapt overboard. Passing by the foul song, next, and once again preceding the complicated man, the crew had to face the twin challenges of Charybdis and Scylla, the former rationalized as a whirlpool and the latter a rocky shoal. However, the implication is that they were monsters guarding the narrow channel between Sicily and Italy, what we call today the Straits of Messina, an extremely volatile stretch of water, even in this day. These the crew passed with ease as the hands of the nymphs were at the rudder and along the Argo, guiding her through. From there they passed the island of Thrinacia and heard the bleating of Helios's cattle. This they bypass and sail on as well. Odysseus and his men unfortunately weren't so wise, if I can remind you briefly of the opening stanza to the Odyssey. He failed to keep them safe, poor fools. They ate the sun god's cattle, and the god kept them from home. Once again coming before Odysseus, they next landed in the land of the Phaeacians, where they are received by the good king Alcinous. Unfortunately, the good king is also receiving the other half of the Colchian fleet, the half that took the Bosporus Channel. The men of Aeetes naturally demand the return of the errant princess so that her father may do as he sees fit with her. Alcinous and his wife Arete, not wanting a war to break out on their peaceful island, are immediately unsure of what to do. As always, the Argonauts vacillate on a plan of action, and it is once again left up to Medea to plead her case. She plies her trade with skill, first appealing to the sensibilities of the queen, then turning her not inconsequential intellect upon the lackluster Argonauts. It worked. Jason and his men riled up, draw their swords, and for a moment it seemed violence would be unleashed. Night wrapped its ebon wings across the palace, and wearied, everyone retired for the night on the promise of the king adjudicating the standoff on the morrow. In their own chamber, Alcinous led on to his wife that in the morning, when judgment was expected, if Medea was not married to Jason, he would indeed hand her over to the Colchians. Patting his head, "There, there, Alcinous," Arete soothed him into sleep and quickly made her way to Jason and Medea's chambers. Made aware of their fate, the pair implored the queen's succour, and she readily agreed to help. She assisted in the rites, and Jason and Medea were married that very night by the water's edge. The bridal bed was prepared in a nearby cave, lined with the golden fleece. Talk about a five-star place to consummate the union. In the morning, the Argonauts and the Colchians assembled to hear the judgment of the king. Alcinous arrived, garbed in all his finery and carrying the golden staff of law. Telling her countrymen that Medea had recently married Jason, very recently in fact, and thus was now part of his household and could no longer be his to pass judgment upon. This really took the wind out of the Colchian sails, so to speak, and like the other half of Aeetes' fleet, they too decided to settle in this distant land, rather than return to a rancorous king. The Argonauts, leaving after a seven-day honeymoon and much erecting of altars to the gods, even though they are so close to Hellas, they are once again blown off course. This time they get run aground on a large sandbar off the coast of Libya. Marooned and forlorn, the crew decide collectively that this time there is no escape and give up, Medea included this time. Wallowing in the sands of this distant land and their own tears, Apollonius likens them to lifeless spectres as they sit and await certain death. Saved by the nymphs once more, three appear before Jason and offer him a cryptic prophecy full of metaphor and double entendres. They really were testing out Jason's brain powers, and considering they mentioned that they had watched him closely during his journey, they might have had a better idea about his neuron deficiency. But they disappear, and Jason does what he does best. Not much. He does gather the men and recount what was told to him by the nymphs. Wily Peleus, who in lieu of Heracles really should have led this band, figures out the cryptic meaning. They are to carry the Argo overland, deeper into the Libyan peninsula, where they will find the Lake of Tritonis, which laps nearby to the Garden of the Hesperides. There, they would receive the help they needed to get out of their current predicament. If the men thought carrying a ship inland across a desert was insane, none ventured to raise it with Peleus. But without any better ideas, the Argonauts lift up the ship onto their shoulders and for 12 days march with its burden across the desert. Finally reaching the lake, they set down the vessel and all drank deeply from the water, having worked up a reasonable thirst on the journey. Here the Argonauts learnt from the Hesperides, the nymphs of the setting sun, that they had just missed Heracles. For his 11th labour, he was tasked with stealing the golden apples of Zeus. Yes, those golden apples. And in the process, he killed the garden's guardian, a hundred-headed serpent known as Ladon. One less thing for the Argonauts to worry about, sure, but they all miss their former crewmate immensely. Triton, the son of Poseidon, picked that moment to come up from his eponymously named lake and told Jason and his crew about a not-far-distant river that would take them back to the Mediterranean. Taking a few days to regain some strength, the Argonauts lost two more of their number in the desert. First, Canthus was slaughtered by some local tribesmen for attempting to steal some of their sheep. Fair enough. Second, Mopsus the Argo's resident seer was bitten by a snake and died of his wounds. Not so bad, considering he could have wound up like poor old Philoctetes with a smelly wound and subsequently found himself abandoned. Apollonius tells us here that the snake that was responsible for the seer's death had no ordinary genesis. That in fact, generations before, while Perseus was soaring above the African coastline with a freshly severed gorgon's head, droplets of dark blood fell from it to the sands below. From these droplets sprang up a brood of deadly serpents. The poison from their bite was so virulent, in moments, all skin, hair, muscle, and sinew rotted away from Mopsus, leaving a gleaming white skeleton for the Argonauts to bury. They made sacrifice to their fallen comrades and the gods, and made their way along the mentioned estuary and back into the Mediterranean Sea. Catching a stiff westerly breeze, the Argo made good time, and when that wind ceased to blow, a southerly caught them and carried the vessel northwards. Day gave way to night, and night to morning, and before the Argonauts lay the island of Crete. Here they looked to replenish the supplies and rest a little more after the previous ordeals, but were greeted at the water's edge by a giant made of bronze, Talos. A possible remnant from the Hesiodic Age of Bronze, the brazen creature was a son of Cronos, who was gifted to the goddess Europa to be the protector of Crete. The island he patrolled the circumference of three times a day. This is all related by the author. The Argonauts didn't have the chance to get into an in-depth conversation with Talos, as the moment he saw the Argo, he began snapping off bits of cliff face and hurling it in the ship's direction. Quickly backing water with their oars, Jason's men brought their vessel out of range of the substitute missiles. Luckily, Medea was aware of Talos's weakness, an Achilles' heel, if you will. Although cast all over in bronze, Talos had an exposed vessel at the ankle that carried his lifeblood, and the Colchian princess knew all about it. Instructing the Argonauts to hold steady and out of range, she mounted the prow and began invoking her own personal cadre of death spirits and phantoms, directing them to the giant before her. As he was still casting rocks, the spirits distracted him so that he caught an ankle against a crag and ripped open the vessel located there. The colossus wobbled for a moment as his life's ichor poured from the wound, finally collapsing with a loud thud. Cheering their saviour, Jason's men rowed to shore and enjoyed a night of well-deserved rest. In the morning, drawing water and supplies from nearby, the party readied to reboard the Argo, wondering where next fate would take them. At this point, it looks like the uncertainty overwhelmed Jason, and he sat there on the beach, arms raised, beseeching every god above or beneath the ground to take him home. His tears worked. Sailing relatively unimpeded from Crete, they reached the island of Aegina off the coast from Athens, and from there back to Pagasi Beach, where the Argo was first built. It's not self-evident to me why, but here is where Apollonius decides to end his Argonautica with the line, "And gladly did you step forth onto the beach." Strange, after having travelled so far, encountered so much in search of the fleece, that the story wasn't taken to what I believe would be its natural conclusion, the deposing of the evil King Pelias. Well, let's finish off the tale of Medea and Jason now. Believing the quest for the fleece impossible and the Argonauts' return unlikely, Pelias had Jason's parents killed or simply told them that Jason had died and they committed suicide. The two best sources for this part of the narrative, Pseudo Apollodorus and Gaius Agenus, have slightly different versions, unfortunately, but I'll stick to the former's take. Imagine Pelias' surprise when the Argo came sailing back into Iolcus. The consternation as Jason handed over the legendary fleece would have been succinct in the mind of the king. You think he kept his end of the bargain and gave up the throne to Jason? Of course he didn't, possibly knowing full well what an insipid hero Jason really was. The king didn't count on Medea, however, whom Jason naturally turned to for help. The Colchian princess told him not to worry, that she would, as always, handle the situation. She invited the daughters of Pelias to dinner, and as the wine flowed, asked them if they wanted to see their aging father live forever. Who wouldn't? And the girls excitedly nodded in agreement. Medea, who had stacked the deck in her favour, brought forth an old ram and sacrificed it before the shocked onlookers. Chopping up the carcass into small bits, she tossed them into a conveniently placed bubbling cauldron. As the last piece fell in, a tiny lamb bounced out seemingly from the pot. It had been beforehand placed to give the illusion required. Scarcely believing their eyes, the king's daughters were amazed and immediately went to their father's chambers. Telling him they had the most amazing surprise for him, they took him before that same cauldron. Pelias opened his mouth to inquire what was so impressive about an overgrown cookpot, but before a word could escape his lips, the naive princesses hacked him into little pieces. Throwing his parts into the cauldron, their excitement turned to alarm as the bits boiled away and no younger Pelias appeared before them. Looking to Medea for assistance, she merely smiled and went to inform her husband of her efforts. This act of regicide certainly gave Jason vengeance, but murder so foul saw him denied his birthright, the throne of Iolcus. Pelias' son Acastus simply took his father's place and banished Jason and Medea from the city. Arriving in Corinth, the two were welcomed warmly by the local ruler, King Creon. Here they lived for a decade and had several children together. There are a few versions of what happened next, but the interpretation I'll go with is from Euripides. It seems that Jason became quite close with Creon's daughter, Glauce, so much so that the king offered him her hand in marriage. Not really sure what he was thinking, considering he was married to Medea and witnessed her terrible powers in the past, but he divorced his Colchian bride and married the Corinthian princess. Even dull-witted Jason was surprised at how well his ex-wife took the news of her abandonment. She even sent the new bride a dress as a wedding present. Much to Glauce's dismay, Medea had wrought her evil arts into the fabric, and when Jason's new wife put on the gown, she burned up in a fire, which also killed her father, King Creon, as he rushed to her aid. Jason perhaps now realized his error, but Medea hadn't finished yet, not by half. Before he could react one way or the other, his ex-wife now visited her rage upon their children, killing them in an act of filicide. Hell hath no fury. In order to escape, Medea summoned divine aid in the form of Helios, her grandfather, who gifted her with a golden chariot, and she booked a one-way ticket out of Corinth. Landing next in Athens, she quickly became involved with its ruler, King Aegeus. The two married and had a son named Metis. All seemed to be finally well for Medea, but this reality was shattered when the king's first son arrived on the scene, none other than our old friend Theseus. Even though he was in disguise, Medea saw through the ruse. Worried over Metis' ascension to the throne, she convinced an already suspicious Aegeus that the newcomer was a threat and needed to be exterminated. Theseus is saved by a moment of recognition, and father and son are reunited. They reward Medea with a gift she was already well versed in, banishment. With nowhere left to go, Medea left Greece with her son and headed home to Colchis. Finding out there that her father had been deposed and replaced by his brother, Perseus, she killed her uncle and restored Aeetes to his kingdom. We're not told, but presumably this allowed bygones to be bygones, and she lived out her days in her homeland, happily ever after. For Jason, he had, in my opinion at least, a deservedly inglorious death. Cursing Medea for what was really his own doing, he returned to Iolcus a broken man, hated by the gods. Even Hera abandoned him for breaking his vows of love to Medea. One night, years later, he took shelter beneath the rotting stern of the Argo. In his sleep, the deteriorated ship collapsed, killing him instantly. Right, in order just to wrap up this retelling, I'd just like to share with you all some observations I've made over the time that I've studied the Argonautica. Firstly, on Medea and her character. Although much maligned by the great tragedians of the classical age, they were first and foremost artists who were seeking to win the approval of their fellow citizens. One can easily imagine a game of one-upmanship played by the playwrights across the various incarnations of the Colchian princess's stories. The earliest versions of her story don't go all the way towards the redemption of her character, but it's clear that by Apollonius's time she had been used as a trope for the evil queen archetype. It's important to remember that when we first meet Medea in the text, she seems to be a timid and innocent person. Everything that occurs after can be squarely laid at the feet of the god Eros and his arrow of love, tainted with his particular brand of mischief. When Aphrodite appears before her son at the bequest of Athena and Hera, he is tormenting Gadamedes by cheating him in a game of dice. Eros is reprimanded by his mother for this and promptly set on the quest to bewitch Medea. You could see a sufficiently petulant teenage boy doing whatever he could to rebel, especially after a good upbraiding. Regardless of her intentions, what's abundantly clear is the fact that without her, the Argonautica would have finished in Book 3 with Jason and the Argonauts burnt and trodden to death by the bulls of Hephaestus, and the good King Aeetes supping wine from cups made from their skulls. Jason, in my mind, is irredeemable as a hero. Installed as leader of the mission above more worthy options, he exhibits none of the qualities commonly associated with the heroes of epic verse. Indecisive, jealous, emotional, dishonourable, and obsequious at almost every opportunity, he fails to rise to any given challenge, deferring to his companions and also Medea. Left to his own devices, he perhaps may have lived out his days in undisturbed irrelevance on the slopes of Mount Pelion. However, he had Hera, Athena, Medea, and the Argonauts on his side, whom without he was just a broken man sleeping on a beach. At the end of his life, he had been abandoned by man and god alike, cradling like a newborn by the rotting carcass of the Argo. That vessel, the vehicle for his journey to fame, also joined him on the journey to Hades, as both lay decaying upon that beach. The Argonauts as a whole aren't much better. Bumbling their way from one end of the known world to the other, they leave a trail of corpses, fatherless children, and broken promises in their wake. For the most part, they are bit players in the evolution of the quest, popping up here and there, never really leaving a lasting impression on the reader. Characters without character. As for the story itself, I've spoken at length in the past about its possible origins. That, like most Greek legends, the Argonautica had Eastern origins is something for which there can be little doubt. Salient to that is the setting itself, which occurs mostly in the east, or in an easterly direction of Greece. A journey in the direction of the rising sun, to challenge the offspring of the sun itself, as King Aeetes is the son of Helios. There, the Argonauts take that place's most significant treasure, a golden, sparkling fleece. That plot puts me in the mind of harvest mythology, where primitive cultures look forward to the returning warmth of the summer's sun after a long and cold winter. Metaphorically speaking, it's easy to imagine such a quest heading off to the distant east to bring back the sunlight so important to the next crop and the harvest. It's easy to consider the story as being one younger than the Homeric epics, and in a completed form, it certainly is. Nevertheless, as an oral epic, the story of Jason and the Fleece predates both the Iliad and the Odyssey. As I've said before, Homer wound his tales over a rich tapestry of oral tradition already in existence. Virtually all the great tales that have come down to us are embedded as mini-narratives throughout his work. The hunt for the Caledonian boar, the stories of the great monster hunters, Perseus, Bellerophon, and Cadmus, Jason and the Argo, and many more. Now, Homer didn't create these stories as interesting asides to his great works. He referenced existing tales to accrue even more popularity to them. Although only appearing three brief times across the two epics, much can be gleaned from the Argo's mentions. Twice in the Iliad, once in Books 21 and another time in Book 23, we learn first Achilles and then Patroclus having dealings with the king of Lemnos, who we are told is the son of Jason. In the first episode of the retelling, I related the episode of Jason and the Argonauts landing on the island of Lemnos, only to find it entirely inhabited by women. Having killed all their manfolk for taking up with Thracian women, their Lemnian counterparts were inviting towards the boatload of Argonauts on their shores. Euneus, the king in the time of the Iliad, is a scion of these unions. This proves two things. One, the episodic nature of the Argonauts story, even in Homer's time, and two, that Jason's narrative is indeed the older one. The Odyssey in Book 12 relates the story of the Clashing Rocks, which we take to be located in the Bosporus Channel. It reads as follows. The only vessel that ever sailed and got through was the famous Argo on her way from the house of Aeetes, and she too would have gone against these rocks, only that Hera piloted her past them for the love she bore Jason. Once again, proof of the narrative's seniority compared to the Trojan cycle, but even more interestingly, at this very early point we can see a different version of events. By Apollonius's time, the Argo defeated the Clashing Rocks on the outbound journey, but we can clearly see that in Homer's time, they contested the challenge on the way from the house of Aeetes, presumably with the Golden Fleece in tow. It isn't clear by which route they originally made for the Colchis, in that older version, but considering that in the late 8th or early 7th century BCE, the borders of the Greek world were significantly different to the Hellenistic period when our extant epic was written. In fact, the first colonies were founded around the Black Sea in the middle of the 7th century by the Greeks. Therefore, it stands to reason that the Clashing Rocks may not have even referred to the Bosporus Channel in that earlier version. Either way, the original supposition stands. The Argo and her quest for the fleece predates the Odyssey. Whether or not it was officially codified before the Iliad and the Odyssey is, however, impossible to discern. Its narrative's conflation with the equally episodic Odyssey is most likely due to Homer's work's preponderant nature over the Greek mythology, but there is plenty of evidence to suggest that the poet of the Odyssey copied the formula used by the epic poet of the Argonautica. I hope you've all enjoyed the retelling of the tale. It has been rather constrained in nature, and if anyone would like more information, I strongly recommend reading the epic. Apollonius brings to life the ancient world of legend for his modern, Hellenized audience, and there is much within it that I had to leave out due to the summary fashion employed. And if you get the chance, do watch the 1963 movie adaptation, Jason and the Argonauts. Loosely based on the Argonautica, it's good old-fashioned fun, and for a 57-year-old movie, has some pretty impressive special effects. Up next for the podcast, we'll be getting back to our focus on Sparta, Sparta, Sparta. And failing any other diversions, that's where we'll stay until the end of this series. I'll be taking a look at the nature of the early Spartan war machine and their expansion into Laconia and then into neighbouring areas of the Peloponnese. So please join me on Sunday the 29th of November for episode 19, The Expansion of Sparta. Until then, dear listeners, take good care and speak soon. Woohoo! Back to one episode a month. Fun as that was, I think a big phew is in order. Please check out my website, spartanhistorypodcast.com, where I have extra information, photos, and maps of the areas discussed. You can find me on Twitter at Spartan_history and on Facebook too at Spartan History Podcast. If you like this episode and are keen to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pods from, and leave a review. See you next time.